Okay, let's start. My name is Marek Vašur, and I'm going to talk about booting blobs between U-Boot and Linux. The talk actually has two parts. I figured at the beginning I'll do some sort of a definition of terms, a couple of terms. I'll go through what is what, so you have that idea, and then once I'm through this, I hope it will also become clear what the problem is, and in the second half I'll tell you how to solve it. So, first thing is bootloader stack. What is this? So, this is all the software that runs when you power on your system and between that point and when the operating system kernel takes over. Traditionally, it was a very small piece of software or no software at all because you just turned on your system and maybe the kernel booted right away, but this was the 80s. These days, embedded systems are much more complex. When it all started, the bootloader stack was usually single project, U-boot, core boot, whatever. This was the 2000s, give or take. The system got powered up, started booting from a reset vector. There was a parallel NOR flash at the reset vector, and the CPU was just executing instructions from that parallel NOR flash. The software did initialize DRAM, loaded the kernel into DRAM, and the kernel was running at that point. Now, it got a little bit more complicated over time because parallel NOR flash has way too many pins, it's difficult to route, and so on. So the hardware vendors figured, okay, well, let's put a piece of software into the SOC itself, that's nowadays called BootROM. This is responsible for implementing complex protocols to communicate with storage, and ultimately for loading small piece of software into internal memory, usually SOC internal SRAM. That small piece of software is the first bootloader which will run on your machine, and it will initialize DRAM, then it will load the next stage. Whatever is running in the SRAM, this could be either U-boot SPL, it could be TFABL2 or something else. What is loading next is usually loaded into DRAM. That could be potentially the implementation trusted execution environment, it could be U-boot itself. It could also be PSCI provider and then U-boot. So as you can see, at this point in the present, where we are kind of now, the bootloader stack is much more complex. It's composite of multiple bootloader projects, some of them closed source like the BootROM, some of them open source like the TFA, some of their free software like U-boot. And it didn't stop here. It's actually now slowly moving toward the future, where the bootloader stack is no longer running on a single core, it's running on multiple cores. When the system powers up, what actually comes up is a safety core, which is small CPU core, Cortex-R, Cortex-M, that runs some sort of a bootloader on it. It does hardware initialization fully. It starts DRAM. It does initialization of the clock tree and so on. Then, only then, it starts providing some sort of a services to the application cores. It brings up the application cores and runs some sort of a bootloader on the application cores, which then starts the kernel on the application core. But I don't want to talk about this today. I'll go one step back to the present, and I'll return to the situation where we are running bootloader on one single CPU core entirely. And the next term I would like to explain is exception levels. This is ARMv8 specific, but other ARM CPUs also, what's up? Other ARM CPUs, the older cores, ARMv7 and stuff before that, they also have exception levels, it just looks slightly different. RISC-V also has similar concept. I'll talk about ARMv8 because this is what I was working with recently and it's easy to understand. So the situation is this. ARMv8 has four exception levels, or you can call them privilege rings, basically, which allow some sort of a layering of hardware access, effectively. The most privileged ring or exception level is EL3. This is basically software that runs in that, has full unrestricted access to everything, all memory, all peripherals. Software in that exception level can set up memory protection tables, it can set up IP it can set up trust zone basically to prevent software in less privileged exception levels from accessing peripherals and memory. That's basically the whole idea behind this. The most privileged EL3, this is where Secure Monitor is running, usually some sort of a basic firmware which has the highest access. EL2, that's where nowadays bootloaders run, Linux kernel and bare metal runs, EL1 is virtualized kernel, and EL0 is applications, unprivileged user applications. The one thing which happens here is that it is possible to switch between these exception levels. You can switch from more privileged exception level to less privileged one simply by setting up CPU context and doing exception return. That's easy because, hey, you are more privileged, so you can switch to less privileged. That's trivial. But you can also go the other way around, and that requires for the less privileged software to trigger an exception in the more privileged exception level. For that, there are two instructions, SMC and HVC. When that instruction is issued in the less privileged software, it actually triggers, it switches the CPU state to a more privileged state, and it triggers exception handler in the more privileged ring. The exception handler is supposed to do some sort of a permission checking and so on, and then maybe does some sort of an action, like something for which the system needs higher privileges. By something, I mean maybe enable clock, maybe bring up CPU core. The thing is, these exceptions, where less privileged software can request stuff from more privileged software, they serve, these exceptions where less privileged software can request services from more privileged software serve as a way for the more privileged software to provide services to the less privileged software with some sort of an access control. But the issue with that is that when there is this kind of a contract between less and more privileged software, there has to be some sort of an ABI, effectively, between those two software components. And that exists. There are actually some standardized ABIs already, PSCI and SCMI, but unfortunately, vendor BSPs, they extend them in all kinds of weird ways. They introduce new shiny APIs, which then suddenly in the next version change ABI, so we have a problem. And the problem is this, effectively, if your bootloader is providing some sort of a service, say to your operating system kernel, or some sort of a previous stage blob provides services to the next stage blob, it becomes an ABI. Once you change one of these blobs and it provides different ABI, you have an ABI break and everything falls apart. That happens. It can happen in two ways, traditionally. If the bootloader is providing ABI and you update the kernel and the kernel expects some sort of a new ABI which the provider which the bootloader doesn't provide, then the kernel will fail to boot, most likely. If you have an AB update, this is still recoverable because the kernel will fail to boot. Okay, bootloader will pick the other kernel, boot the B copy, and you can recover. This is the better case. But if you have the bright idea then to say, okay, well, my kernel needs a new ABI, let's update the bootloader as well, and suddenly your kernel doesn't boot, then also your bootloader provides new ABI, the B copy doesn't boot, and your system is basically unusable. That's it, game over. So the issue I will talk about next is how to solve this ABI problem. But before I get into it, there is still one thing which was mentioned to me while I was preparing the work and